All right, friends, we're nearing the end. Do you feel how little there is left of the booklet? I am so proud of you, but let's keep our seat belts on, I guess, because we're still driving, hypothetically, metaphorically. Okay, so we're on page 53 and page 54. We might do this in one whole chunk, or we might do this in two pages. We're gonna have to see how long I talk. But this is the priesthood in the Old Testament, and then, of course, the priesthood in the New Testament. And we're gonna do it in four acts, okay? You see at the top of your page the squiggly timeline of up, down, up, down. So there was God's original plan, and then plan B, and then back to the original plan, and then the plan foiled, okay? And that's the priesthood in the Old Testament. We'll talk about the priestly roles, because here's the thing. Understanding priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church, the men wearing black with their white collars, consecrating the Eucharist, that only makes sense in context of the Old Covenant priesthood. Jesus didn't just make all this up willy-nilly. He drew on the wealth of understanding of what a priest already did to make his priests of the New Covenant. So let's start with how God made his priests in the Old Covenant, and then we'll build on that, okay? So, starting with the original plan began with Adam and Eve, okay? In Genesis 2:15, God tells Adam to work and guard, or to till and keep. Same types of words, okay? Work and guard is used again in scripture when it's talking about the priests and their role for the temple. Their job is to work the temple and to guard the temple, to till and to keep. Jews recognized Adam as a priest and Eden as a temple, okay? The original priest, the original temple. Now, of course, the full-on temple of Solomon wasn't built till much later, but we see the development of priests here in Eden, and then we see a big shift in the desert, in the tabernacle. But let me not get ahead of myself. Okay, so he works and he guards the temple. Adam is the first priest. And the priesthood was passed on from the father to the firstborn son. Okay, just like the birthright, just like the bloodline staying in the family. We see the fathers of the house offering sacrifice, leading the family in worship. They're responsible for the covenantal relationship. The patriarchs function as the priests for their tribe. And then we see, in kind of this early world, Melchizedek. Melchizedek is that unusual, kind of, I was going to say suspicious, but he's not suspicious. He's just an unusual figure who speaks to Abraham years and years after Adam. And his name is Melchizedek, King of Salem. Salem is peace, okay? He is the king of Jerusalem, or where Jerusalem will be. He, of course, points forward to Jesus because he offered a sacrifice of bread and wine. But he's a king of righteousness. That's what Melchizedek means. That's his like throne name, okay? King of righteousness, Melchizedek. That's not his real name. Jewish tradition says that this man, Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, is actually Shem, the son of Noah, who would have been the firstborn son of Noah, who would have been the priest of the family, okay? And he's got the priesthood of the firstborn son, which he passes on to Abraham, because we don't know who Abraham's like, father is. We don't see his father being a priest passing it on to Abraham, but we see Shem passing it on to Abraham after Abraham tithes to him. Okay, in Genesis 14. So, anyways, that's kind of the original plan, and that's kind of what we got going on until, I mean, if you know your story, the Exodus, or rather the slavery happens, okay? Joseph goes down, is sold into slavery in Egypt, brings his whole family down, and they all get enslaved for 400 years in Egypt. They're not in their promised land, and they're not passing on the firstborn priesthood anymore because they're worshiping false gods, they're trapped in slavery, they're totally not with it anymore. They get Egyptianized, okay? But when God delivers his people through Moses, he tries, his original plan is to restore the original plan is to get back to the priesthood of the firstborn. Okay. During that last plague, when the angel of death passes over any of the families who have blood on the doorposts, the firstborn son of any unmarked house dies. So it's a firstborn son plague, but it's also a firstborn son consecration. The firstborn sons of the Israelites are consecrated to be priests again. Okay, and we start to see them, they're called the young men, that kind of help Moses as they do the Exodus, okay? They help Moses to offer sacrifices at the foot of Mount Sinai. Their royal priesthood status of Adam is offered to Israel as Adam's nation, Adam's people. Now they get Adam's priesthood, okay? But They revert back to Egyptian worship, and the firstborn sons lose the priestly status. Okay. Moses goes up the mountain for the covenant, and he comes back down. Everybody's worshiping the golden calf, and he says in Exodus 32, Moses says, "Who will stand in me and the Lord?" And he's expecting the firstborn sons, the young men who he's already consecrated just 3 months prior, to come to his aid, but they don't. Who comes to his aid? His own tribe, the Levites. So God kind of moves on to plan B. The original plan of the firstborn son being the consecrated priest, that's gone. Now the Levites are going to be the consecrated priest for the people. Okay? The priesthood Jesus, by the way, is sharing with the apostles is from Melchizedek. It's from the firstborn. It's from the Adamic. But this plan B, the Levitical priesthood, reigns for most of the Old Testament. Okay? But it is plan B because the young men who are the firstborn, that order of priests, lost it. They did not do what they should have done. Let's talk a little bit about this plan B situation, okay? All of this happens at Mount Sinai in the desert with the establishment of the Levite priests. Moses says to the priests after they stand up and defend God's honor, he says to them, "Today you have ordained yourself to the priesthood of the Lord." This, by the way, is an honor to be the priest of God. It's a privilege, and the Levites are about to be treated super differently than the rest of the tribes. For starters, they don't have their own tribal land. They're going to have a tithe of everybody else's land, and they're going to live among the people because they're going to be responsible for being the mediators between the people and God. The people need the Levites in a way that they don't need other tribes, and in a way that they shouldn't have needed the Levites because they had a priest in every family, but now they don't. So they do this ceremony in Exodus, where they count up the firstborn and they count up the Levites, and they make a ceremony of discrepancy between the numbers to ensure that there's enough Levites to cover all the families, okay? And then the book of Leviticus is delivered to Moses throughout his time in the desert, kind of giving instructions. And Deuteronomy, of course, is another rule book and stuff. So we pull from Deuteronomy 17 here to see that the priests become the authoritative interpreters of the Torah and of the law. The whole law that was just given to the people through the book of Leviticus, through the Ten Commandments, kind of the family law of God and the covenant, this is given to the priests to interpret. Okay? By the way, this is a non sola scriptura moment in the Bible where it's not just up to the people to read the commandments and to understand it for themselves. They're supposed to read the Bible, not the Bible, the law, and understand it because it's explained to them by the authority given to them. The Catholic Church today is not so crazy to have the magisterium, to have the hierarchy of the church, the priesthood, explain to us what the Bible means. We were never supposed to have it all by itself, okay? This is all the way back to Deuteronomy, like the fourth book of the whole Bible, okay? But if you had a question about what's going on here, you ask the priests. And if there's a judicial decision that's too difficult to make, you ask the priests and you do exactly what the priests say. Okay. In Matthew 16, we see Jesus giving the same type of authority to Peter, and in Matthew 18 to the rest of the apostles, that they now, just like the priests in the Old Testament, have the authority to interpret the law. Okay. There's other things going on here. Okay. Let's keep talking about the Levitical priesthood, which is still in plan B. They have a different relationship with the other tribes now. Okay. They're the mediators. People have to go through the Levites to interact with God. The Levites receive the sacrifices and they offer it to God. They are the face of the people to God and the face of God to the people. Literally in their whole tent, like camp enclosure thing, it's the tabernacle in the middle and the Levites all the way around it, and then the rest of the people. So literally it's like you got to go through the Levites to get to God. Okay, in chapter 17 of Numbers, there's this revolution where this guy named Korah and his companions, they want to be the priests. They see that the Levites have authority, so they have a revolution. And of course, they get squashed. And then in the next chapter, number 17, God confirms that Aaron and the Levites are the high priests because Aaron's staff blooms. So there's this miracle of Aaron's staff blooming, which, by the way, in the New Testament, there's this tradition that Joseph, the foster father of Jesus, the husband of Mary, his staff bloomed in order to pick him as well. Pretty cool. But anyways, that's not in scripture. That's a tradition. Okay, let's keep talking about plan B here. So the priests participate in warfare by carrying the ark. Only the priests, the Levite priests, are supposed to touch the ark, carry the ark. There's a specific way they're supposed to do it. And every warfare in the Old Testament is like an act of spiritual warfare. It's a procession. It's horns and trumpets and stuff like that, because By the way, the other people that they're fighting, the pagans, are also calling on their gods to help them. So here are the Levites calling on the God of Israel to help them as well. Now, there's a bunch of differences that God starts to set up in the liturgy and the worship of him that sets him apart from the other gods. One thing is that he makes it clear that he is God and leader of the people by kind of using the language that the people understand. The tabernacle that he instructs Moses to construct for him, the place of worship, uses Egyptian technology. It looks like, it acts like the movable war tent of Ramesses II. Okay? So just like the Hebrew slaves probably have seen the movable war tent of Ramesses II, they're probably like, huh, this looks familiar, this tabernacle thing. It looks like the tent of Ramesses. But inside the tabernacle with God, with the Ark of the Covenant, there is no idol of God. There is no image of him. There's no human, of course, sitting down on the throne between the two cherubim. The mercy seat between the two cherubim atop the Ark, it's empty. And that's notable and strange because there in the movable tent of Pharaoh, that's where Pharaoh would sit. But in God's tabernacle, in that inner chamber between two cherubim on the throne, there's nothing because you can't see God. And there's no idol. And he said, don't make anything to look like me. He's using contemporary culture technology to communicate a different message. He's using familiar architectural language to communicate a message that I am God. Just like you expect to come in and see God, but you don't see God because God is invisible, because God is bigger than Pharaoh, because God is different, okay? And the Levites are the ones who are closest to this, okay? Sorry, I say okay a lot. I realize that, but whatever. Here we are. Page 53. You're probably used to it by now. Okay, so the priests offer sacrifice. The priests are the authoritative interpreters of the law. And they're honored. They're revered. We'll see this in a minute, but when the Holy Family goes to the presentation in the temple, the reason that they have to pay for to redeem the firstborn son is because the Levites are the stand-ins for the firstborn son. And the firstborn son has to like pay a tax and a tithe to say, thanks for doing the job that I'm supposed to be doing. Okay, so anyways. Okay, so the Levitical priesthood lasted for a very long time, okay? It lasted until David, okay? Now, you might be like, wait a second, it lasts until the time of Jesus. There's still Levitical priests around. Yes, but we'll get back to that, okay? First, we're going to go back to the original plan with King David. We see King David do a lot of good things. I know he's a murderer, adulterer, but before that, he is a great king and a conqueror. He conquers all the rest of the promised land that Joshua was unable to conquer. He, you know, extends the boundaries of the promised land. He unites the 12 tribes. And then it says he sits down on the seat of Jerusalem. He resumes the Melchizedek priesthood, which at this point they have not had access to, okay? So the Melchizedek priesthood, the father-son priesthood, that's what David resumes. That's what he accepts and reclaims, okay? And we know this 2 Samuel 8, the very last verse of this chapter says, all of David's sons were priests. This says that the priesthood is no longer the Levitical priesthood. Now it's going to be back to the father-to-son priesthood, okay? And that's good for just a little bit. Half a second, we're kind of back. And it's like, okay, Jesus is going to be from the line of David. Jesus is going to get this Melchizedek Adam priesthood. This is awesome. And then the plan is foiled in 1 Kings 12 when there's a divorce in the kingdom. The North Kingdom and the South Kingdom appear because they split off, okay? And the North sets up a false religion. Okay, a false religion where there's golden cows involved and they have their own priests and it's all different. So it's the plan is foiled. And then the people go into exile and they're totally unable to do their sacrifice and their worship and they're not able to keep their priestly line doing the priestly thing. Okay, so after the return, they come on back from all that mess and they restore some of the priesthood. We see the book of Ezra. He is reteaching the people the law. He is restoring some of the priesthood. But that only lasts for a little bit of time because as soon as they rebuild Jerusalem, the Greek guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, he takes over Jerusalem. Alexander the Great takes over Persia. And so the newly freed Jews who come back out of the Persian Persian king lets them go, but the Greek king captures them again, okay? They're tossed all around. And this ushers in the time of the Maccabean revolt and the kings, the Hasmonean kings. If you're not familiar with all of this, I apologize. Go look at my Old Testament course. There's so much that kind of can be explained through the foundation of understanding what's going on in the Old Testament. But long story short, the divide of the kingdom kind of wrecks it again. The return of the kingdom kind of starts to heal it. And then the Maccabean family, the Hasmonean family, takes the throne, and they're able, if they want, to give that priesthood back to the Levites, or to give it back to the firstborn sons, or whoever they're supposed to give it back to. And instead, they keep it, okay? They have a non-licit high priesthood. Jonathan Apphis, he's one of the Hasmoneans. He corrupts the high priestly line. He actually lets Greece decide who's going to be the next priest. So the people lose confidence in the leadership of the temple priesthood. They don't have the original priesthood. They don't have the Levitical priesthood. And the Pharisees insert themselves into that religious leader vacuum. The Sadducees are not to be trusted because they're starting to sell out to Rome. They're kind of with the Hasmoneans. The Pharisees are like, okay, wait. We got to keep the law. We're going to be the new Levitical priests. And then, of course, the Essenes run off to the desert and say, we don't want anything to do with any of you guys. So Annas and Caiaphas are high priests at the time of Jesus, but they're imposters. They're descendants of a corrupt Jonathan Apphis priesthood that they had the opportunity, the Maccabeans, to restore the priesthood, but they didn't. So it was only back to the original plan, that third dot on your timeline, for a short bit with David, because Solomon is the one who kind of got the kingdom divided. So it was one generation of kind of being back, and then the plan was foiled again. So when Jesus comes on the scene, the Levitical priesthood is kind of still reigning, but Jesus is the line of David. He has the priesthood of the firstborn. He doesn't go become a high priest in the Pharisee, like Saul, St. Paul, he's a Pharisee. Jesus could have done this. He went to rabbi school, but he didn't do that. He didn't become a Pharisee. He didn't become a high priest. He didn't become a Sadducee. He didn't become famous in the eyes of the world because he's doing his own thing. He's a high priest from the line of Melchizedek, according to Psalm 110. And that's the priesthood he confers on his people, sort of. Okay, so the priestly roles include the Torah and sacrifice. Those are the main things. The Torah is the law, the binding and the loosing of the law, the interpretation of the law. Like I said, Matthew 16, this is given to Peter. Matthew 18, this is given to all the apostles. And the Pope, or the apostles as a group, have authority. We see this. It's called an ecumenical council in these days. But we see this in like Acts, I think it's like 13, where they have a meeting and they discuss if Jews have to be circumcised before they become Christians, or if not, and they discuss and they decide, and James defers to Peter and says, oh, you were right. But they have authority together. Okay, this is why we still see ecumenical councils happen. This is why we see the Pope and the Magisterium getting together, because they have the authoritative interpretation of the Torah. This is not very strange, I guess, in the world today where we've got Catholics and we've got a bunch of different Christians, and usually the Christians can interpret for, you know, maybe within their own church council, but kind of for each man for himself what one piece of scripture says. Catholics are like, no, well, I believe what this random group of men over in Italy say, and I just believe them. Yeah, we believe them because they're the ones who are in the line of the priests who, like, God gave authority to bind and loose. So we're a lot safer going with what Jesus instituted as authority rather than our own authority. We are priests, but we have the common priesthood. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so the Torah is the first duty of the priest to put in that little box on the right side of your page. The second duty of the priest is sacrifice. The role of the Levites is done when the tabernacle and the temple is replaced by Jesus. Okay, they do animal sacrifice all day, all night. They do it. Tons of sacrifice. And they do things like, you know, going into the Holy of Holies and going into the holy place and lighting the candles, doing the things. But once that temple is gone, there's no need of them anymore. Now there's a new sacrifice that has replaced the temple sacrifice, and it's the Mass. And the apostles do the Mass. And they are like the Levites who surrounded the tabernacle. Now the priests are the way by which we get access to the church. We get access to God through the priests, through the sacraments. We get the Eucharist through the priests. The priests are the face of God to us and the face of us to God. Now, of course, the veil was torn. Now we get to actually have more intimacy with God than the Old Testament people thought they were allowed to have. We can totally pray in our own homes, totally, but the sacraments still come through the priest. We cannot just say, the priests aren't important. I can do this for myself. You cannot do it for yourself because you are not ordained to have authority to interpret the law and to sacrifice on behalf of yourself. You need the priest to do your sin offering, confession. You need your priest to do the sacrifice of the Mass for you. So we, the common priesthood, we make the world holy. We live in the world. And we're supposed to sanctify the world. But the ministerial priests, they're supposed to make us holy. They're supposed to sanctify us. Okay? So we play together. Now, the priesthood of the New Testament, they still have those same duties of the priests, the Torah and sacrifice, as I mentioned. Sorry, I should have mentioned that earlier, but the same thing, the binding and the loosing, Matthew 16, given to Peter, Matthew 18, given to all. And then the ecumenical councils and the authority to interpret. And then the sacrifice. So they have the Torah and the sacrifice. In the sacrifice, they do Mass and the sacraments. Okay, let's talk about the apostles acting like priests for just a second. Because they do throughout Acts of the Apostles, throughout the letters, and of course we know through the tradition of the church that they act like priests all the way up till now, of course, but it's just nice to see it in scripture. Now I'm going to refer you back to the other page because all throughout the sacraments page we're talking about, we saw examples of the apostles moving with the sacraments, praying with people, laying their hands on them, anointing them, appointing them, ordaining them, etc. So the apostles are acting like priests. The first thing they do, though, is they replace Judas with Matthias. So the fact that this office of Judas, that there was 12 seats and one of the seats got emptied because Judas killed himself, and the fact that they think, we should fill this. There can't just be 11, there should be 12, and we should fill it, as in we have the authority to fill it. They're already acting in their authority, because at the Last Supper, Jesus ordained 12. He for one for every tribe, you know, he gave 12 authorities. So these are offices. So we see apostolic succession already happen. When one dies, another one gets replaced. So as soon as Peter dies, another pope replaces him. It's an apostolic succession thing. If all the apostles had the authority to interpret and to sacrifice, and then they all died, the church would literally not be able to survive. And Jesus said it was going to survive until the second coming. So anyways, in Acts 1:15 and onward, they replace Judas with Matthias. They have a role that does not end with their death, and they do the thing that the high priests of the Old Testament used to do, casting lots in order to decide, okay? They also, their role is a supervisor slash overseer. It's called episcopen. It's the same word later leaders in the church, the bishops, are called. This word is used in Acts 2:28, Philemon 1:1, 1 Timothy 3:2, Titus 1:7, and it's referring to the apostles as the bishops, as the overseers, as the rulers, okay? The early church is a new Israel, okay? It's composed of scattered tribes, new converts, and Jesus promised the apostles they would sit on 12 thrones judging the tribes. So the Sanhedrin, that group of priests, is like the old Israel, and the early church is like the new Israel with the new 12 thrones, 12 priests judging the tribes. Okay, let's go back to out of the ethereal and back to the practical, though. In Acts 5, a married couple lies to Peter and drops dead on the spot. They abuse the authority of Peter. They don't respect the authority of Peter, and they die. In Acts 6, we see the apostles appointing deacons to serve to feed the widows. They're doing ordination, showing that they have the power to appoint and ordain. This is a top-down structure. This is not a democracy. The early church is not electing their own leaders. It's the hierarchy. The people that Jesus chose are electing leaders to replace them, which is how the church works now. We don't vote on the new pope. The cardinals choose the new pope. Okay, last thing, and I know we've already mentioned this, but let's just run through it again. When does Jesus actually give authority to the apostles? It happens slowly over time. It's not all in one moment, but at the Last Supper, do this in remembrance of me. He gives them authority to do the Eucharist. John 20, breathing on them after the resurrection, he gives them power to dispense sins. Matthew 16 for Peter and Matthew 18 for the rest of the apostles, he gives them authority to interpret the Torah. And, yep, those are the big ones. Okay, so that's the priests in the New Testament and the Old Testament. We are going to go on to Mary on the next page, but I guess if I could summarize priesthood in the Old Testament and New Testament in one last word for you, it would be that the Old Testament priesthood totally gives way and makes sense for the New Testament priesthood. There has to be a priesthood, this is how God set it up, to mediate between God and man. Jesus is the one who became the priest to mediate between God and man. Check out Hebrews like 12 to see more about that. Hebrews 5 and Hebrews 12, that he is the perfect high priest. He's a high priest who can understand us. He's a high priest who is low enough, who has lowered himself to us in order to love us and understand us. And he didn't just leave. He left us in the good hands of the church, the messy hands, the imperfect hands. I know that there's like a crisis of priesthood where not every priest represents the church very well. That doesn't mean that the church is wrong. It means that the church is made up of imperfect people. But there's imperfect people at the time of Jesus too. All throughout the whole church, there's priests who have done wrong. There's people who have done wrong. The only ones who have not done wrong is Jesus and Mary. Okay, so that doesn't mean if you've been hurt or scandalized or anything by the priesthood of the Roman Catholic Church, that's horrible. And it doesn't discount what Jesus did and how he set up the Old Testament to have priests mediating and the New Testament to have priests mediating. It's still part of our faith, just like it really has been since Genesis. Okay, next page.